Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is in the Zoom room with us from Cambridge. Senator Warren, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
It's great to be with you. And listen, this is serious business. There's a lot of policy that I want to talk about, but I want to have a little fun first because I have been thinking about sweet, fluffy Bailey in all of this heat, that poor pooch with all that fur. So how is Bailey doing in the heat?
So we, like all good people who work for our dogs, set the alarm, got up really early this morning, so he could do the full loop of Fresh Pond before it got too hot. And now he is literally lying on top of one of the air conditioning vents.
To cool back off again.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough life for a golden retriever.
That's right.
His job is to be loved, and he's good at it.
Well, now that I've gotten my Bailey fix, thank you. We can get down to business. And I'm going to start with a couple of local news issues. I'm sure you're aware. Here in the Commonwealth, the state legislature ended session with the $4.5 billion economic development bill still in limbo. There were some things in that, like permanent tax cuts, a potential seat on the MBTA board for the city of Boston, housing benefits, a whole bunch of stuff. There's been pressure that they ought to return. State Senate President Karen Spilka has said there's more work to do. They ought to come back. But today's Boston Globe editorial quotes House Speaker Ron Mariano as saying, quote, "People have vacation plans. I'm not going to start negotiating winners and losers of the economic development bill in the first week of August," end quote. As somebody working on the federal front, do you feel like the legislature should be back in business taking care of this? Or do you think there's time in informal session?
You know, that's the real question. Do they have another period of time that they have mapped out where they can straighten this out? If not, this is the job, like it or not.
And you do feel it needs to be straightened out?
It's got to be straightened out. And look, they've done some really terrific work. The particular one I saw is that, as you know, just last week, we managed to pass through a bill for veterans around burn pits, people who had been exposed to all kinds of toxic chemicals at these burn pits around the world, where the United States was in conflict, and finally getting them the appropriate relief. And the state legislature moved in, which I thought was really smart, and has a veterans bill that they've just passed in order to make sure that all of our veterans here in Massachusetts can get hooked into this new law right away, get the relief they want with as quickly as possible, and get everything they deserve. So I'm really happy to see this from the state legislature, but we got to have all the pieces working.
So let's stay with that then. You brought up this veterans bill, the PACT Act, which sits on President Biden's desk. Just for listeners, it provides health care and benefits to veterans injured by exposure to toxins at war. They don't have to prove the source of the injury, adds 23 conditions to the VA's list of presumptive illness. I want to look at the politics of this.
Sure.
There was an earlier version. It had passed with bipartisan support. There was a technical error that required another vote in Senate last week. And in the second vote, 25 Republicans switched sides. And I want to play you a little sound. You may have heard it before, of John Stewart, the famous John Stewart, who's been an advocate on veterans policy, reacting to that switch strongly on the problem with John Stewart.
Every one of these individuals that has been fighting for years to just get the health care and benefits that they earned from their service. And I don't care if they were fighting for our freedom. I don't care if they were fighting for the flag. I don't care if they were fighting because they wanted to get out of a drug treatment center or it was jail or the army. I don't give a shit. They lived up to their oath. And yesterday they spit on it in abject cruelty. These people thought they could finally breathe.
So obviously there, and I do want to correct, the new show where he's been reporting is the problem with John Stewart. Obviously some very strong reaction there at the thought that this might have been gamesmanship in protest to the compromise on the Inflation Reduction Act. Do you think this was gamesmanship?
Yes.
And are you angry?
It was gamesmanship. I mean, and look, let me explain exactly how we know that. The bill that they voted for originally had nothing changed when the Republicans, 25 Republicans, then voted against it and tanked it. Nothing changed. And then when they got a lot of heat publicly, not just from John Stewart, but from lots of veterans all around the country, they voted in favor of it again. And there were no changes in the bill. This was not like, oh, we compromised and we added some more conditions or some more money. It's the same bill three times for which the Democrats, all of us, voted yes, 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 all three times. But the Republicans in the middle voted no because they were unhappy that the Democrats were going forward with a climate prescription drug tax bill that they didn't want us to go forward on. So they just decided they would take it out on the veterans. I don't know what else you call that, except political gamesmanship, the worst kind of cynicism. I thought it was just despicable.
So for the playbook, for those who supported the veterans bill, John Stewart proved to be a really effective advocate on that. Are there lessons to be learned for other pieces of the legislative agenda in the Biden administration, for our congressional delegation, in the relentlessness of his platform in pursuing this?
Yeah, and I think you really have focused on it. It's not so much about John Stewart. It's about what it means when the rest of us get roused on it, when people across the country, in this case, veterans and veterans organizations, they were in 110%. John Stewart was the tip of the spear, and good for him and very, very grateful. But what gave it power was not a celebrity endorsement. It was the fact that literally millions of people across this country were activated. They knew it. They didn't like it. They wanted to push back. They said it's time for Congress to act. And by golly, they got it done. In a sense, that's exactly how democracy should work. Someone talks about a piece of something that's happening, and then other people get engaged. And this is a way for Washington, not just to hear, we could hear if we wanted to all the time, but a way to really push Washington so that Washington isn't just working for the billionaires who hire all the lobbyists and make all the campaign contributions, but is actually working for the American people.
So I'll pick up on that thread of millions of people around the country who are exercised, because certainly that is the case on abortion. I'm going to bounce us back and forth, local and national, on this one. Governor Charlie Baker will have a signing ceremony today codifying further action on abortion here. A couple of the key pieces there: more clarification about what is a legal abortion after 24 weeks, more protections for providers against reach-outs, criminal reach-outs from other states who might want to reach into this state for prosecutions. I know you know that last week the vice president held Massachusetts up as a model. Are you satisfied with where the state law is around abortion rights in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I think the state law is in a good place, and or about to be in a very good place here in Massachusetts. But I always want to sound the warning about no one is sure what will continue to unravel. We're in the first wave of the post-Roe world, and we still live in an environment where Mitch McConnell says that if the Republicans can seize control of Washington, then they're going to ban abortion all across the country, and it won't make any difference what Massachusetts has done. They will make all abortions, illegal here in Massachusetts, illegal in Kansas, illegal in Illinois, illegal in California. So we've got that part of it that we still have to be very, very vigilant on. And that's about the races that are coming up, the elections in, what is it now, 96 more days?
Yeah, when just about 3 months. So that,
yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you brought that up. So the phrase you use, no one is sure what will continue to unravel. So there has been a bipartisan bill aimed at protecting some abortion rights called the Reproductive Freedom for All Act. You are not in favor of that one. You're calling instead for President Biden to codify those rights through executive action. And I get it, in your criticisms of it, that for one who wants extensive abortion rights, it puts right against right now. And you've said it doesn't really change the law where it is. But if it can further codify something that does exist, given what else you don't know will unravel, why not support it in the short term on your way to a more fuller accomplishment of the agenda you'd like to see?
Well, the problem is it doesn't offer any protection. It uses the same undue burden standard that the court was using, or that for example, the state of Mississippi used when it said no abortions at all after 12 weeks, and that John Roberts, in his concurring opinion, said, hey, we can go ahead and let Mississippi do that under the undue burden standard that is in this so-called compromise bill. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing with Texas. As long as a bill in Congress says, hey, the courts can go bless whatever the state legislatures do under the undue burden test, then we haven't advanced the ball at all. Indeed, I think we've made it worse, because we've said now the legislature's stepping in and saying to this extremist Supreme Court, keep it up, only use the language undue burden instead of flatly declaring that Roe is gone. But it would still unleash the states, as many of them already have been, to continue to ban abortions. And that's why I just can't support it.
We're talking with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren here on WBUR. Senator Warren, you said you referred to 12 weeks in Mississippi. I think it's 15 unless undue burden
is three weeks sooner.
Okay. So I do want to pick up one more thing on this subject, which has to do with crisis pregnancy centers. This summer, you introduced the bill Stop Anti-Abortion Disinformation Act that you said would limit these centers from using advertising to dissuade women from getting abortions and have to disclose that they don't provide those services. At least some centers here in the Commonwealth are licensed. They argue that they're transparent in their materials about their approach and that in some cases they do provide medical services like ultrasounds. Have you been invited to visit a crisis pregnancy center in Massachusetts? And have you gone to see one? Have you engaged directly with one of these centers?
No, I have not been invited. But let me be clear. If they are transparent that these are not centers that provide abortion services, then we don't have a problem. My concern is that someone's pregnant, they're under a lot of stress, they want to terminate this pregnancy, and they type in on their Google search, abortion services, where can I get an abortion, what does an abortion cost? And the first thing that crops up says, we help with crisis pregnancies. We can give you full information. You go to the website. The website uses the word abortion over and over and over. Someone makes an appointment and goes in, gives all of their personal information and medical information, believing that they are in a center that will provide an abortion, and only find deep into the process that they are not. They are in a center that is, in some cases, willing to give inaccurate medical information in order to keep this person from having an abortion.
And
And when they leave, they then have given up personal information, medical information, that if these are not healthcare centers, which most of them are not bound by federal HIPAA laws, privacy laws, which means they can do anything they want with that information, including giving it to other states. If someone, say, came in from Texas in order to receive an abortion here in Massachusetts, in order to harass a person.
Have you heard from a constituent that this has happened to?
I have talked with people who have, I want to put this very carefully. I have spoken with people who've had very troubling encounters with crisis pregnancy centers.
Thank you. I do want to pick up student loan debt before we run out of time, because the moratorium on payment end of August.
Yep.
Are you directly or currently in touch with the Biden administration about their plans for what comes next? Do you know what's on the horizon?
I'm not going to talk about private conversations, but I am going to say this. Let's go back to our conversation about the burn pits.
Yeah.
Why did we actually make something happen? We made it happen because people all across the country said that the Republicans blocking this was outrageous and it needed to stop. There were a lot of people who said the right thing to do is to support our veterans. The more people who say in the next few days or few weeks, it is important to cancel a big chunk of student loan debt. It is important to help people get rid of this debt, then the more likely it is that this debt will be canceled.
Would a 10K chunk? No, so there's been back and forth. President Biden for a long time has talked about something around the 10K range. You, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who was on with us last week, she advocated for 50. That seems to be where you've been. If you can get 10, will you take 10?
Look, let me put it this way. The reason I focus so hard on 50, and so does Ayanna, is that this is where we get the maximum impact. That is, the greatest number of people who will see their debt wiped out, that we will begin to close the racial wealth gap, and we will give the most help to people who do not have college diplomas. Keep in mind, just a couple of quick things about student loan debt. 42% of the people who have student loan debt do not have a college diploma. They are trying to manage student loan debt on what you make as a high school grad. They tried, God bless them, and pregnancy, trying to work three jobs, somebody got sick, didn't make it through to get a college diploma. So they don't have those earnings. If the number is high enough, we can actually wipe out most of the debt for most of those people. Same point around the racial wealth gap. Right now, African Americans and Latinos borrow more money to go to school, borrow more money while they're in school, and have a harder time paying it off when they get out of school. One quick fact, 20 years out, the median white borrower owes about 6% of what they originally borrowed. You know, geez, after 20 years, still paying, but the end is in sight. The median Black borrower owes 95% of what they originally borrowed. If we get the number high enough, the Black-white wealth gap for borrowers can narrow by, at $50,000, by as much as 27 points. That's the most any president could do to help close the Black-white wealth gap in America. So all right. That's why I keep pushing for a bigger number.
That's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What difference could it make if every child in Massachusetts got a small subsidized state savings account at birth? Potentially a lifetime's worth of change. They're called baby bonds, and joining us now, Shannon O'Brien. She's a former Massachusetts state treasurer and the chair of the current state treasurer's baby bonds task force. Shannon O'Brien, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you here. So I gave a little synopsis of baby bonds there, but maybe you can flesh that out a little bit more. What is it?
Well, sure. I think your last guest, Senator Warren, was a great tee up to this. You know, the fact is, you know, since the late 1970s, early 1980s, we've seen an increasing wealth gap in the United States. In Massachusetts alone, you know, the average net worth for a Black family is $8, you know, where it's in the hundreds of thousands for a white.
$248,000, according to the report in 2015.
Exactly. And so it's looking at this issue of wealth gap because many studies have shown you think, oh, you know, you're just going to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, go to college, get an education, and then you too can enjoy the benefits of the middle class.
But that's up there. We're talking right about babies. So connect that down.
Well, we're talking about, again, just the bigger issue. And again, it's the issue of wealth gap. How do you create a tool that will allow for transformational wealth, or at least move in that direction? So baby bonds are a way to invest in generally babies living under the poverty level who will have an investment made on their behalf with the either state or federal government. There are different, you know, presentations that are being granted on both the national level and at the state level. And it is invested over time. And then with interest, it becomes a meaningful amount of money that can be used either to pay a down payment on a house, pay for a college education, subsidize vocational training.
And when you say little amounts of money, $500,000, $1,500?
Well, the devil's in the details. And this is what we've seen. In Washington, D.C., they have seeded a program that, at least in its first iteration, will probably end up with approximately $15,000 to $20,000 per child. Connecticut has also done something like this. And in theory, they invest for every baby over a number of years, and then with
so
compounding interest, $11,000. Yeah, so it's a cumulative investment. Some have talked about Cory Booker's plan talks about as much as $60,000 that are given to young people when they turn 18.
So let's talk about Cory Booker's plan for just a second, and I'm going to bring that up because Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley has talked about that plan. Wait, I want to make sure I've got the right sound here. Sorry, I actually wanted to pull up a particular set of sound. Let's just play the sound, and then I'll tell you the context afterward. Go ahead.
We cannot level set to a pre-COVID unjust, inadequate, and insufficient normal. This is the sort of prescriptive, targeted, race-conscious policies that we need to be advancing at this period of reconstruction.
Okay, she was with Cory Booker. That is the 2021 American Opportunity Accounts Act. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey here in the state also co-sponsored it. And the reason I was scrambling to find that one and bring it to you is because you said at the beginning, lower-income children. We know that there is a pushback in the country around anything that seeks to preference communities that have experienced systemic racism, systemic oppression. So what about the pushback, for example, on affirmative action admissions at Harvard University, that this should be everyone or no one?
Well, I mean, I think that we've seen in the last 40-some-odd years that persons of color, that persons below the poverty level, that they have lost ground. After the Depression, World War II, we saw a great compression. We actually saw an equalization between the persons living at the very top level of our, wealth in our society and the bottom levels. And since the 1970s, that gulf has grown, whether it's tax policy. As a matter of fact, we just had a tax policy here in this country where we did not blush at handing hundreds of billions of dollars back to the top income earners because that would be important to our economy. This is an investment not only in children who don't have that intergenerational wealth that other families use, that whether they help them to pay for college or to start a business, that wealth is not there. It's creating that corpus of wealth that can transform someone's life and help them launch where they did not. I think of myself. My parents paid for my college education. When I was starting a business, my family invested in me. Not everyone has that kind of wealth lying around. And that's what this does. It closes that gap by saying each child will have some ability to access some wealth that allows them investing in a business, paying for college tuition, paying for training, or paying to launch a business.
We're talking with former State Treasurer Shannon O'Brien about baby bonds. She's the chair of the state's Baby Bonds Task Force. One more question to you, and then I'm going to add a second voice to this. What about the argument, which often comes up when we talk about government subsidizing individuals with cash transfers, benefits, et cetera? This is a private investment. We're talking about private savings. Fine, but don't use my tax dollars. Find private contributions, private voluntary contributions to fund this.
Pay me now or pay me later. If we don't allow people to access the promise of America's economic bounty, then those people, end up, living on benefits, for a longer term. We end up paying more if we don't allow people to do this for themselves. And this is literally just a tool that allows someone to seek that economic benefit that we think is the promise of America. But again, I just point back to some of our tax policy. The reason that wealth gap has been exacerbated is because we have seen wages staggering. We have seen tax policy that has benefited generations of primarily, you know, white and middle class and upper class people. And these are the people who have been left behind. And so that's why this is, it's an investment. It's not a handout. It's an investment not only in individuals, but it's also an investment in our economy and our social safety net.
Okay, Shannon O'Brien, stay with us. I'm going to add another voice here. Kofi Kenyatta is the director of policy and practice at Up Together. It's a nonprofit that researches cash transfer programs like baby bonds. Kofi, welcome to you as well.
Welcome. Good to be here.
And I just want to note, Up Together is formerly the Family Independence Initiative. And several years ago, more than a decade ago, I ran a foundation in Boston that made some contributions at that time to Family Independence Initiative. So just want to be transparent on that. Kofi, your reactions to what we've heard from former State Treasurer, Treasurer Shannon O'Brien here.
I absolutely agree with some of her comments. We have over 400 years of solid evidence that points to intentional policy decisions that have led to the wealth and income gaps that we see today. And so we reject any framing or quasi-analysis by some of the very beneficiaries of these racist and deficit-based policies in an attempt to put the onus on the individual. We know that poverty is a policy decision, and policy proposals such as baby bonds are a step in the right direction.
So Kofi Kenyatta, I'm going to play a little bit of sound from you, for you here. This is Cambridge Mayor Sumbul Siddiqui here on Radio Boston in May. They are working on a program called Cambridge Rise that's giving direct cash payments to low-income households. And here's a little bit about use.
It's food. It's, you know, trying to get childcare so they can get maybe an advanced degree, a medical assistance degree. These are all stories that we're hearing. People are looking for more economic stability so that they can hopefully get some more economic mobility.
I'm aware that Up Together's work has advanced and researched around the importance of cash as a flexible way, that money is more flexible for problem solving. Is there research to back that up? And is this flexibility an important part of something like a baby bond versus you can only use it for college, let's say?
Absolutely. You know, one pillar of our strength-based approach is choice. And so we've had a presence in Boston since 2010, where our cohort members saw an increase of 27% in income increase, 187% in their savings growth, and nearly a third improved their credit. And so these outcomes are witnessed via our historic model, where we only invested $3,200 over 2 years, along with the community aspect of our approach, where individuals form groups and exchange ideas and resources. Up Together is a big proponent of cash plus community. We realize the value that community and our social networks have in achieving social and economic mobility for all.
So Shannon O'Brien, Chair of the State Baby Bonds Task Force, you just heard Kofi Kenyatta talk about small amounts of money, $3,200, with some pretty big results over a couple of years. You were talking about much larger amounts of money. Is that necessary? Could this be done smaller?
We're talking two ends of the spectrum. One is direct cash that impacts the family and the child in the short term. This is a long-term investment, you know, literally, you know, a bond, like a savings bond that accrues over time that grows to a large enough amount that it can be seen as transformational. You know, you look at maybe a 3% down payment on a house. We were looking at, you know, the Connecticut program, which is about $11,000 that their initial program is targeting to give to, you know, babies who were born this past year and when they turn 18. 3% of a $400,000 house is around $11,000. So that could be transformational. That is where most people have their wealth, is in purchasing a home. And so that's what really baby bonds are for. It's less the sort of day-to-day, and this is not accessible by the parents. It is strictly for the child when they are born to create that longer-term opportunity at an inflection point when they're 18, where they're going to school, getting a job, you know, or trying to start a business.
So Kofi Kenyatta, let me come back to you at Up Together. A number of years ago, there was some criticism of that short-term model that people can slip back into poverty. They get short-term cash. It helps solve some short-term problems, but other things can lead one to slip back into poverty again. Is there something to be said for short-term plus long-term and the choice and control going to the child when they reach adulthood at 18 versus the resource for the parent?
Absolutely. And so it's important to note that income and wealth, which is what we're talking about with direct cash transfers and baby bonds, are both components towards upward economic mobility. And so as Shannon mentioned, that direct cash transfers can be useful when we talk about basic needs to achieve their self-identified goals. But when we talk about baby bonds proposals, that is really when we talk about the wealth gap and really equipping children as well as their families in order to close the historic wealth gap that has been created by deficit-based and racist policies. And so we believe that we need both. So income assistance as well as wealth-generating opportunities that were denied for so many.
So Up Together, Director of Policy and Practice, Kofi Kenyatta, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So turning back to you, Shannon O'Brien, former Massachusetts State Treasurer, recommendations are due in November. In this conversation, I get the sense that the recommendations will be how, not if. Is that right?
Well, yes. And it's really looking at some of the models, whether it's, you know, Cory Booker or Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, what the state of Connecticut has done. California is looking at this. Washington, D.C. has actually done this and funded the first 4 years of the program for the first couple of cohorts. The fact is, it's trying to find out what we can do that is a best practice, but also that is doable. You know, we also know that, you know, here in Massachusetts, we've had significant surpluses in our budget. And then 2 weeks ago, you know, we found out that there is a 1987 law that may require the legislature to return almost $3 billion in, you know, overage of collected funds.
Yeah.
What will that funding be? How are we going to do that? We think that this is answerable. We think that this is doable, but the devil's in the details.
All right. 1986 law triggered in 1987. That's mm-hmm. Shannon O'Brien, former Massachusetts treasurer and chair now of the State Baby Bonds Task Force. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Well into this pandemic, sometimes it feels like we have all become amateur epidemiologists. We know the common symptoms of regular COVID, fever, sore throat, difficulty breathing. And we're saying, wait, are we having allergies? Is this COVID? Is it something else? What we're still learning a lot about is long COVID, where the symptoms persevere after the initial diagnoses. And we may have some new answers. WBUR's Priyanka Dayal-McCluskey has been reporting on research to solve the mystery of long COVID. She joins us now from the newsroom. Priyanka, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So we have been reporting on long COVID for as long as we've known about long COVID here on Radio Boston. The definition is encompassing more symptoms and issues all the time. So give us the snapshot of today, as of today. How do we define it?
So in a broad sense, it's when someone has symptoms from COVID that last for weeks or months, or it could even be years. And it can look different from one person to the next. The symptoms can happen all over the body. So that means fatigue, chest pain, fevers, cough, trouble sleeping, trouble thinking, stomach pain, and a lot more. And one of the perplexing things is that it can happen to people who actually started out with a mild case of COVID. And many people get better with time, but then others got sick back in 2020, and they still feel sick more than 2 years later.
So in your reporting, you drew on some parallels. Two things, there's chronic fatigue syndrome, and there's myalgic encephalomyelitis. What do those have to do with long COVID?
So that disease is called ME/CFS for short. That's a chronic condition that causes really severe fatigue. And that fatigue doesn't necessarily get better when people sleep. So sometimes patients with this syndrome can feel so sick that they're just bedridden and they can barely walk or talk. I spoke with Dr. Lisa Celine. She's a professor at UMass Chan Medical School in Worcester, and she studies the immune system. And she's also been living with ME/CFS for decades, most of her adult life. She has managed to work full time, but sometimes her disease flares up. And when that happens, she has to slow down. This is how she described to me her very worst days.
With every severe episode that I've had, I do feel like the walking dead, and I do feel like I've come back basically from being dead each time.
So that sounds pretty scary, but it might actually sound familiar to a person with long COVID.
So are we following that thread, making this connection between that illness and long COVID?
So ME/CFS and long COVID turn out to be very similar, and many doctors and researchers are now starting to think about them as even the same disease. In addition to causing fatigue, both are known to cause brain fog, which it means difficulty thinking and remembering things, and ME/CFS and long COVID both can trigger something called post-exertional malaise. That means that just a few minutes of exercise or even a long conversation can cause a really severe energy crash. I talked to a long COVID patient named Nisha McCray. She's in her 30s. Before she got sick, she was really active. She was a runner. She had a busy work schedule. Now everything feels harder for her. That means even socializing, preparing a meal or a cup of coffee can be totally draining.
When you say you're fatigued, it's not just, oh, I can get over it if I take a nap. It's, I can't even brew a cup of coffee that's just a K-pod without destroying 6 hours worth of energy.
So that kind of fatigue you hear, that can be really life-changing, especially for someone who's pretty young and healthy, and now they can't do the things they used to do.
Okay, Priyanka Dale McCluskey, stay with us. I'm going to go to another voice. I'll come back to you in a little bit. Also joining us now, Dr. Sabrina Asumu. Dr. Sabrina Asumu is an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center, and you know Dr. Asumu well from Ask the Doctors. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
So reactions to what you just heard from Priyanka's reporting, Dr. Asumu?
Yeah, no, I think it was actually a very helpful story because it humanizes what a lot of us have been seeing in the literature and clinical settings in terms of what it is that patients who have long COVID are experiencing and how the science and the scientists are trying to make those links and those connections. What we've learned for a long time is that viruses can lead to longer side effects and more long-term conditions, such as what you've described, a chronic fatigue syndrome, which some of the clues that have been cited in the literature include an infection with Epstein-Barr virus, which is also known as EBV, that could be related to that. So we've known that viruses could do this. And what we're trying to learn and starting to learn about is how the SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, could also lead to similar condition.
So we reached out, Dr. Asumu, to members of our texting group to see if they had any questions for you on this subject. And I have a couple for you. Jane from Scituate says, quote, I never tested positive for COVID-19. How do I know if I was ever infected? And how would I know if symptoms are long COVID or something else, end quote.
Yeah, that would be really hard to know because, you know, earlier in the pandemic, you know, we didn't have access to tests and a lot of people don't know if they were infected. But the way that we are sort of identifying those who may be at risk for long COVID is whether or not they've had symptoms that could have been attributed to long COVID. And then if they're having symptoms that are suggested of long COVID. So what I would recommend is talk to your primary care physician to first try to get a story that's more specific to what's happening to you and understand whether or not the symptoms that you have could be from long COVID.
I'll ask another question from a listener. Nancy from Cambridge asks, quote, are you any less likely to get long COVID if you are vaccinated and fully boosted? Is there anything besides not getting COVID that you can do to lessen your chances, end quote. Dr. Sabrina Asumu.
I love that question because I was going to make that point. If it hadn't been made, you know me, you've called me the vaccine evangelist is because I'm
you
all
are.
And so vaccination. So number one, the best way to avoid long COVID is, first of all, to not get COVID, right? But also to not get reinfected with COVID, because the more episodes you have, the more likely it seems that you may get some of the long-term complications. Earlier in the pandemic, we had some data that seemed to suggest that if you were vaccinated, you could decrease your chances of getting long COVID by about 50%, but those studies weren't that great. The more recent studies have shown that it's probably closer to about 15%. But my message is, if you get vaccinated, you're less likely, number one, to get COVID and less likely to get some of those complications. So we're hoping to learn more, but getting vaccinated appears to definitely provide some advantages related to long COVID.
So I'm just going to turn back to Priyanka Dayal McCluskey, who's still here in the studio. Just quickly, we've heard a couple of answers from Dr. Asumu there. Anything in that tracks with what you were discovering as you were doing your reporting?
So in terms of vaccination, I think one of the challenges is people who were getting sick in 2020 before vaccines were even available. So they that wasn't an option for them at that point. But it does, you know, we are hearing from Dr. Asumu that this is still happening. This problem is still with us.
So Dr. Asumu, back to you. There is this. There are two sets of ongoing discussions when we talk about long COVID. One is how much could be psychosomatic or symptoms of other things, like, for example, a depression, versus what is as a result of the virus. Do we have clarity there, and is that still part of the medical conversation?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So what is the good news? The good news is that we have ongoing large studies from the NIH called the RECOVER. The RECOVER study, and actually my hospital, Boston Medical Center, is one of the sites. And what we're doing is actually enrolling patients and following them over time to try to understand, to have better definition of what is long COVID, and to try to understand other markers or biomarkers that we could actually identify to diagnose people and follow them over time. So that's been kind of the big challenge. You are correct that there's been a question as to, is this just depression or is there something else going on? My sense, especially from like talking to patients and also knowing what viruses can do, it seems very real. And we just need to study it a little bit more so that we can, number one, have a better definition and diagnose patients and provide potential therapeutic options to lessen the symptoms. So this is an ongoing area of research.
We're talking long COVID with Dr. Sabrina Asumu of Boston Medical Center and WBUR's Priyanka Dayal-McCluskey. Staying with you just a little longer, Dr. Asumu, why do we not have long flu? Why do we not have long cold? Why do we have long COVID?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting and spot on question. You know, these viruses are all very different, and maybe sometimes There are certain symptoms that we may not necessarily identify because we don't have that many patients who are infected in the first place. And so if it's something that's rare, it may not be obvious initially. But, you know, we do know that certain viruses, for instance, Epstein-Barr virus, so EBV, which has been implicated with chronic fatigue syndrome, we do know that it's been associated with those more long-term complications and suggestions.
All right, Dr. Sabrina Asumu is an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center and a regular help to us on Ask the Doctors. Dr. Asumu, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
So turning back to you, Priyanka Dayal-McCluskey, here at WBUR, what are you? You're a senior health reporter. What are you going to follow next?
Yeah, so as Dr. Asumu said, there's a lot of research underway here in Boston and across the country. So I'm really curious to see where does this research go, what kind of new treatments are going to become available for patients with long COVID and ME/CFS. It's possible that the same treatments could help patients with both of these conditions. And is there a way, are researchers going to find a way to help people with long COVID before they end up living with their symptoms for many years? These are really big questions, but, you know, people are working to find the answers, and there's more than $1 billion of federal money going to this work. And there's a lot at stake. One medical group, the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, they estimate that as many as 27 million Americans are living with long COVID symptoms. So a lot of people are waiting for help.
Yeah, that's hard. So we have a little bit more time. I think what I want to ask you, Priyanka, is, was there anything during the reporting for this story that really made you go, huh, like caught you by surprise or you just didn't see it coming?
I think it was just really eye-opening to hear from patients about how these diseases are impacting their daily lives. Just the ability to, you know, make breakfast or lunch, it's like something that we, many of us, take for granted. That is a daily struggle for many people. And oftentimes, I heard this a lot, that they don't get They're not always believed about their symptoms, and so that makes it even harder when they are struggling.
Did you hear that? I have told people this. They don't believe me. They don't think this is real.
Yeah, absolutely. That kept coming up with all the patients that I talked to, as well as the doctors, because these diseases are just not very well understood. And so even within the medical community, sometimes there's skepticism.
All right. Priyanka Dayal McCluskey is a senior health reporter at WBUR, joining us in Studio 2 today for your first time from the newsroom. I really appreciate the time. Thank you for coming in and sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we go today, we wanted to take a couple of minutes to reflect on the passing of national icon and local treasure, David McCullough. The acclaimed author and historian certainly had the accolades. He was a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, winner of 2 National Book Awards, and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor that can be given to civilians. But McCullough was perhaps most well known for his incredibly compelling storytelling and for always believing the best about America and Americans. He last joined Radio Boston back in 2017 when he was in town to help kick off the centennial celebration at the JFK Library. He told us then about how when he heard Kennedy deliver his famous New Frontier speech as a young man in his late 20s, it completely changed the course of his life.
When he called on us to do something for our country, I took it entirely to heart. I quit my job. I went down to Washington. I knew no one in the Kennedy crowd, and I knew no one in the government. And I got very lucky and wound up at the U.S. Information Agency. It's been a long time since we've had a president call on us to do something for our country and not just wait for our country to do something for us. And that was, it was as novel then as it would be today.
McCullough was also here with us in studio to talk about his newest book at the time, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. It's a collection of 15 speeches that McCullough gave at graduations to Congress at the White House, with added information, reflections, and illustrations. While he was here, he talked about what he hoped readers would take away from the book.
When bad news is riding high and despair in fashion, when loudmouths and corruption seem to win out, to own center stage, when some keep crying that the country is going to the dogs, remember it's always been going to the dogs in the eyes of some, and that 90% or more of the people are good people, generous-hearted, law-abiding, good citizens who get to work on time, do a good job, love their country, pay their taxes, care about their neighbors, care about their children's education, and believe, rightly, as you do, in the ideals upon which our life is founded.
David McCullough passed away Sunday at his home in Hingham, Massachusetts. He was 89 years old. And that's our show for today. Hey, join us tomorrow at 11 a.m. We will be live at WBUR City Space for the next in our series of Democratic primary debates. WCVB Channel 5's Sharman Sacchetti and I will host the 3 Democratic candidates for Massachusetts Attorney General. You can watch live in person, you can listen here, or you can watch it streaming at WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com. Also, join our texting group to stay more in touch with the show. You heard us use questions from our listeners just a few minutes ago. To get started, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Again, that's the word Boston to 617-766-0382. We really would like to hear from you. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with help from Bart Tachi. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks, as always, for listening. Join us again tomorrow. It's going to be a thumping good Radio Boston.